this is Brad with Rogue Cell. On Tuesday, November 11th, Veterans Day, we're gathering at the Liberty Theater in Astoria for a community event rooted in service, story, and connection. We'll begin at 4 p.m. with a Veterans Fair, a space to meet, share, and connect. Then at 5 p.m., we'll premiere our documentary, Battlegrounds and Backroads. This film was born from long roads and quiet conversations. It's a reflection of the voices we carry and the landscapes we call home. Whether you served, supported, or simply want to listen, this evening is for you. This is Rogue Cell. We're building something rooted, something real, and it starts here.
We're here with another veteran, Tom Jenkins, and he is here at Vet Coffee in the Elks Lodge.
Good morning.
And we're just going to go through the questions here, so make it easy. First off, what branch did you serve in and when?
So I recently retired out of the U.S. Navy. I've been retired now for a little over 1 year, and I was a sailor with the U.S. Navy for a little over 12 years, and prior to that, almost 8 years of active duty as an airman in the U.S. Air Force.
So you got to catch all the Pokemon. You got to get the Space Force in there and everything.
Oh, yeah. I went from JetBlue to WetBlue, and I know.
So when was this?
So I made the transition 2011. Believe it or not, it's true. The Air Force has a lot of things the other branches don't. They have a holiday early release program. If your contract is up,
of course they do.
You can get up to 30 days cut off to be released from service early. And so early birthday present.
We call that terminal leave in the Army.
Early Christmas present, rather, in 2011 is surprising my girlfriend at the time by getting discharged before Christmas instead of after Christmas. And then I was already talking with a Navy recruiter in the Puget Sound area, and the Navy recruiter called me on the first day of the new fiscal year and said, I got a job for you. As soon as you're off contract, we can have you fill out the paperwork. And I let him know, hey, I've been approved for early release, so this is when I'll be in your area.
Oh, so you just didn't really have any time between. You just went right from one to the other.
I got to enjoy being unemployed for the month of December and early January. And then January also is when I started college on the GI Bill in the Seattle area. And yeah, one of the things I learned through my transition assistance program was that I was eligible to apply for unemployment. So I got a little bit of unemployment during the holiday period to help make ends meet.
Nice. Good. Between jobs.
Which also was helpful because they don't tell you that the living stipend for the GI Bill comes at the end of the month.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the month.
Yes. We learned that the hard way when my wife was using my.
So, Tom, this is the other Sean. The next question, which I think is unique for you, is what did your time in service mean to you then and now? But what's unique about you is what did your time in service mean to you in the Air Force, and what did the time in service in the Navy mean to you?
So, great question. Follow me on a curious response to that. So I'm from a military family. My dad, who recently passed away, was a retired Navy veteran. And for the Cold War era generation, the Vietnam War generation, their capacity to talk about their own service was a lot more diminished than what we have seen in the Global War on Terror era of veteran. So for me, joining the Air Force versus my dad's Navy was a little bit of teenage rebellion, but also it was an opportunity for us to have something more in common, to where he did start to open up about his own experiences and trying to coach me from a distance as to what I could expect, because now I was a wartime enlistee in the military.
Yeah.
And then when I transitioned over to the Navy, the floodgates truly open, because it's like, okay, shipmate, now you're in my Navy. Let me tell you how we do things. And then when I was selected for promotion to chief petty officer, which my dad retired as a chief petty officer, similar to the Elks Lodge that we're in now recording, it was like, all right, you've been initiated into the mysterious order. Now let's really talk about when things get weird, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And so for me, I mean, it was a way to better connect with my family and to continue a tradition of public service on the national stage. And now reflecting as somebody who's retired themselves, I very much see it as an opportunity for me to not only get to know different parts of the world, because I've got a chance to live in foreign countries, visit foreign countries, live in many different parts of the U.S. that my family's not traditionally from. It's helped me get to know my country a lot better.
Yeah.
I realize as different as we are, e pluribus unum, out of many come one.
So I wanted to talk about the continued service. Yeah, your family served, you served, and now that you're out, you have continued to serve in a way.
Yeah. When I came off of active duty and went back to school to finish my education, I was fortunate enough to get a job with Oregon State Civil Service. So I have been a civil servant here in Oregon for over 11 years now, between two state agencies. And I've lived now in the Astoria area for the longest time I have ever been continuously in one spot since I moved out of my parents' house in 2005.
I am the exact same way.
And putting down roots here, me and my family have gotten an opportunity to really get to know our community and our neighbors and to see things come up that are of public interest in the public spotlight and find ways that we can get involved, try to support the parts of the community that we really value and we cherish, and the people that we've gotten to know also find common cause in, and then ways that we can try to make the community better by pooling our collective energy and our attention. Now we're in a position to advocate for that.
But pulling that and trying to make the community better, you've also run for office and might run for office again.
No, nothing is off the table. I was a candidate for office earlier this spring. So I got a chance to see what democracy in action looks like from the other side of the looking glass. And all the things that they don't teach you at public school or even higher education about how our system of government works, you can learn by just sticking your hand into the machinery and seeing which finger gets snapped off first.
That's awesome. Right, we got more people, but you want to ask the last question?
Sure. Tom, what do you wish more people understood about veterans in rural Oregon?
Just as veterans are not monolithic as a community, rural Oregon is not monolithic either. It just means that we're a little bit farther away from the I-5 corridor than some folks may be comfortable with. And just because we live out here too, like me and my family, doesn't mean that we're from here originally. Like rural Oregon has both people who are multi-generational residents and parts of those communities, as well as people who have come from other parts of the country or other parts of the world. And being a veteran out here, especially on the edge of America, you know, the ocean is about 3 miles in any given direction.
It doesn't get any more edgier.
We're not on the way to anywhere. Yeah. And nobody ended up here by accident. Yeah. And especially as we get ready for fall and the winter storm season to come in, this is the time of year when residents out here in rural coastal frontier Oregon know to be ready. They know who in the community they traditionally have to look a little bit harder after, because they may have some difficulties taking care of themselves or taking care of their property. And neighbors helping neighbors is what Oregon has been all about ever since Lewis and Clark stumbled their way down the Oregon Trail. And so we're continuing that out here. And veterans are front and center in that, because we are used to being given incomplete information, poorly maintained resources, but a very important job, and told, figure it out. True.
That's true. It's true. Right on. Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, guys.
We're here with Ralph Fisher. What branch did you serve in and when?
I served in the Army ASA. Army Security Agency.
Never even heard of that.
No, it was secret.
Oh. What years did you serve in the Army?
I went in, enlisted in 71, went in 72, and got out in 74.
So, what does your time of service mean to you now?
It means that I look back on it and think, what a great opportunity for myself. At the time, my daughter was born with a congenital heart defect, and I was in high school, no money, and I decided I would supplement that by volunteering to go into the Army. There was a draft going on at that time, but I enlisted. And my daughter was operated on at 6 months old in Walter Reed Hospital. She had a tricuspid problem, so that's three valves instead of four. She's alive today because of the Fontaine procedure that was performed there. And she is in line for heart transplant and liver transplant as soon as she gets a donation, and she's going into Walter Reed to have that done there.
Still.
Oh. Yeah.
And, well, and it's because you were in the military that she got the treatment.
Yes.
Wow. So, wow. So you're,
but I mean, just, it was in the military hospital that performed it.
Yeah.
But I was in the military, and so I paid for.
Yeah, right. No, they really have some good doctors. When I was blown up in Iraq, I thought for sure I was going to lose my hands because it was just hanging there, and they put it back on. I can use it. I can play piano if I knew how.
Yeah.
So what helped you feel a sense of camaraderie during or after your service, which I guess is a kind of a difficult question, you know, coming out of Vietnam?
Actually, the camaraderie of feeling that my military service was worth my time in happened when I moved to Astoria 3 years ago.
Wow.
And I always, you know, you walk into a place and you have your Army significant thing on a pin or something. And someone says, oh, thank you for your service. And I like to say, you're welcome. But, you know, I was 17 years old. I didn't really have a whole lot more choices to do. So, but you're welcome. Anyway.
Yeah.
But then moving here and hearing about the veterans group that's meeting and every Thursday getting together with all you guys and just hanging out and listening to the stories and realizing that people gave up so much. I didn't really feel like I gave up so much. I got a lot out of my military service. I got my education, but I got out of the service. I had 4 years of college that was paid for by my by the service. And so I feel like I had a win-win-win.
But you found community here.
I have.
That's good. That's good. And we're trying to show other vets out here who might be listening or their veterans, spouse or family members and like, hey, get your vet into coffee. We're cool people here.
That's right.
You can find that community that'll help, you know?
True.
So, all right. One last question.
Yep.
Ralph, what do you wish more people understood about veterans in not only Oregon, but more specifically rural Oregon?
I would like people to remember that that we're people, that we care about our country, that we care about preserving our freedom and supporting that, not that we can do anything but support it because I'm too old to go back in, but I can give whenever I have some extra funds or I can just speak out when I'm in a public place. Someone says, thank you for your service. I can say, yeah, well, you're welcome for that service. And I just think being outwardly vocal about having served is important too. I wear a little insignia of my Army service, not a big one, just a little pin on my hats or on my I have a keychain that I have U.S. Army veteran, and I don't mentally pull that out to show somebody, but it's just there. And that's what I think is important, is just to be there and out there and ready to say, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really awesome. I really appreciate you sitting down and talking to us.
Thank you, Ralph.
This is Brad with Rogue Cell. If you're just joining us, we're at a veteran's coffee at the Elks Lodge discussing service with several veterans today. Join us for a warm and formal gathering of veterans and community members every Thursday from 9 to 11 a.m. at the Astoria Elks Lodge. We share stories, reflect on service, and build connection over coffee. You don't need to be a member. Just bring your presence and your voice.
So we're here with Gary Kieske.
Kieske. You can use your normal voice to say that if you want.
We're here with Gary Kieske. What branch of service did you serve in and when?
I was in the submarine service in the Navy from September of 63 to September of 66, active.
Oh, man, we got to get you on our own interview. We got to interview you just because you were in the pre-nuclear subs.
I rode two diesel electric boats that were launched in October of 44, and I was born the day we bombed Nagasaki.
Oh, wow.
So those boats...
Your submarine's older than you were.
Yeah. Well, we went to yards every couple, 3 years, you know.
How far underwater were you?
As far as we needed to go, you know.
I just can't imagine being underwater and something that old. I wouldn't want to drive something that old across the county.
When we were in the shipyards, we watched the welders. The fire watch on the welders wasn't just to see what the sparks were. You watch those guys weld.
Make sure they're making a ship that's not going to...
I've heard scarier stories from people on nukes who had come up underneath something and had gotten damaged and boats put back together. And the sounds they made as they were going down and testing.
Oh, man. Repair, I bet.
The hums and the whistles and the creaks and pops.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk to you longer because I remember you saying, like, you guys had to be super quiet on these subs because if you're too loud, the Russians would hear you.
Well, if that's where we were there part of the time. Of course, we didn't. We didn't talk about it where we were. We were supposed to be, as long as we were invisible, we were cool. That was our job. But if we were holding under 4 or 5 knots, or slowly, we weren't cavitating much. And the nuke at the time, our fast attack boats hit a slightly noisy pump on their secondary cooling system. Just a little bit, but we didn't have one of those noise makers. So it was primitive sonar. My two watches a day were sitting by myself with a headset on.
Oh.
And the microphone was a set of hydrophones under the bow. And I just listened. Whatever, if there was a vessel or vessels in the area, I had to figure out what it was and what it was up to.
Through the sound it makes.
Yeah, through all the sounds, the associated machinery noises, and we used to say you never make the same mistake once.
We got to do a longer interview.
Well, you know, I tell the guys in the car tomorrow what was happening with every pulse.
Never make the same mistake once.
It was we were the quietest thing in the ocean then for a period of time. But
and it's ironic that you're a musician. And well,
I grew up
spend your life making noise.
I grew up as an orchestra violin player, so most of playing music is listening. Unless you don't ever think about it, but. No, that's I was a listener, and that's what when I was in boot camp and we did all those tests, I thought I wanted to be a helicopter mechanic because I'd heard you could. Those things needed 10 hours of maintenance for every hour in the air.
Oh, so you don't death at this point.
It's a brilliant job when you get out. I like that. But I had no measurable hearing loss.
Yeah, that's great. I'm envious.
And the victory at sea on the or submarine service, whatever it was, yeah. On the television must have, I guess I took the idea that the submarine force, especially in the middle years of the war, lost half of their people.
Oh, wow.
Highest attrition rate it was.
And yeah. Well, it's dangerous. That's really dangerous.
I thought that was that might be a challenge. And it was. And with the submarine school was the first time I ever had to study. And gotten by his,
Well, what does your time in service mean to you now?
Defend the Constitution. Didn't have an expiration date.
Yeah.
So I am very sad that this economic system that is oriented toward growth of profit,
yeah,
above all else,
probably
commandeered our government of its checks and balances.
Yeah.
And, the 60s, when I'd seen enough in Asia, yeah, in the small places they put us, we would have a little bit of a break. Seen enough about the way people from other places live, and I would talk to Europeans. We were in Asia. When I got back, I understood that the ghettos in this country that were on fire weren't there by accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have concerns about trying to go for zero population growth. Come to a point where people don't read books. They're incapable of reading. That suggests you don't learn to think critically, because yeah, that is what happens when you read.
What do you wish that people understood about veterans in rural Oregon, and specifically the North Coast?
There is a relatively high percentage of veterans in these counties west of the Coast Range. And in rural Oregon, because of our love for the private automobile, public transportation for everybody, but for veterans who are especially us older folks who don't have much income, just being able to get places and engage with people and not be hermits,
mm-hmm,
is important. And I find what you guys are doing to be vitally important.
I like that, because that's something I really haven't thought about, and it's really hugely needed. And I think it's something that we can actually affect change in.
We can work on.
Let's make that one of our deals. Well, thanks so much for sitting down and talking to us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And we have to get you in for your own episodes. I want to hear more submarine stories.
Well, you're so we spelled really bad, but we did a good job.
Gary, I have a question for you in regards to your submarine service. So one of the questions that was on here is, what helped you feel a sense of camaraderie during or after your service? But where I want to make a little more personal is, did you feel a camaraderie or a connection to those welders and those machinists when you had to put your trust into their welds and everything, and then being underwater? What are your views of those welders and those machinists?
I sincerely hope they took their work as seriously as they could, and they understood that there were going to be 85 people whose lives were dependent upon their not making a mistake.
So the reason I wanted to ask that question too is because my grandfather, Alvin Johnson, he was a machinist at Pearl Harbor. And that was his job, was he even attempted to enlist in the Navy in like the day after Pearl Harbor. And they said, no, Al, we need you here fixing our ships. And so that's a very personal question. And so it's nice to hear your take on him.
Like my Uncle Ralph, who was a Marine in '60s, that's what he did, was, and he was certified for underwater high pressure welding. So that's pretty cool. It's like, so we definitely have to talk and have your own episode. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Have you guys talked to Carl Rogers?
No, we don't get to talk to Carl.
I met him when he was here last year for the Writers Festival.
He's really a nice guy.
He was. He said he would talk with us at some
point. Yeah, he was born here, right?
He went to Seaside High School. He was in Marine WOTC in Oregon, but he was over in England on a Rhodes, and he kept getting letters from his buds who were in Vietnam. And he couldn't take going to school when he should be with them. That was his.
Yep. I can see that.
So, yeah, I did. I've chatted with him on a few occasions. He's good friends with my friend Peter Lindsay.
Get us his contact info and we'll definitely reach out.
This does keep me from being a hermit, you know.
Oh, it's good. We wanted to motivate other veterans to come out to the coffee because it's important, as you know. I mean, this is what helps people out, helps us out, helps me out. Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, so we got to talk to a lot of interesting, cool people, veterans. That's what it's all about. We're trying to build community, and I really believe we're succeeding here. All of the stuff that worked for me and worked for you that we like kind of show in our documentary, we're actually doing. We're leading by example, and we're out there doing it. And I know that we've really done some good in this community so far. And on that note, our documentary is done.
It's done. It's done. We have we're both waiting for each other to talk. So we have a premiere date set for Veterans Day. Doors are going to open at the Liberty Theater at 4 p.m. And 5 p.m. we're going to show.
On November 11th. We'll have our radio show before then.
And we're going to have a Veterans Fair attached to it, too, if I can get some organizations online for that. It'll be a great event.
So if you're a veteran organization out there and if you want a table at a Veterans Day event in the heart of Astoria, the beautiful Liberty Theater, contact us. You can get a hold of me at Sean, S-E-A-N, at roguecell.org, or Brad at roguecell.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Together with Veterans Northwest Oregon or the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition or the Department of Veterans Affairs. You can find us at roguecell.vet or facebook.com/groups/roguecell. If you or a loved one is experiencing thoughts of suicide, help is available. Please call 988 and press 1 for veterans. This line is answered 24/7, so there is always someone to help. And with help comes hope, and hope saves lives. The second of the 503rd Rogue Cell is produced by Brad Peitzig with support from Together with Veterans and is hosted by Sean Davis.